The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Whatever it is, they're against it. But UKIP are surging in English council elections as protest votes flood in from across the country. Meanwhile, the Tories lose in Cameron's pet council of Hammersmith, and Labour fails to capitalise fully on a night of anti-government sentiment. The Lib Dems edge closer to the margins with another poor election showing. And also this week, we'll be asking if unelected politics would be any better, because Prince Charles has been overheard comparing President Putin to Adolf Hitler. Joining me for all of this, we have The Guardian data supremo, James Ball, commentator and Lib Dem voice editor Stephen Tall, and our political sage, Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Now, from watching the news as the results come in, you could be forgiven for thinking that Nigel Farage was about to become our next Prime Minister, rather than leader of a party controlling no councils and with zero MPs. But that said, UKIP clearly had a good night, and with most of the results of England's council elections now in, the electoral map is becoming clearer. Labour have most seats as expected and have made the most gains. The government parties have lost the most seats. James, there's a desire to impose a narrative on the results as they come in at random from around the country. Is there really any kind of clear picture at all here?
I think in the early morning, a lot of the media was quite keen to do this story about UKIP surging ahead, the earthquake, the sort of tremors from which British politics would never recover. And if UKIP had an excellent night, they've had a fairly stodgy morning. They're kind of the councils that were going to do best for them did quite nicely for them, better than we expected. And so,
like,
especially you're looking at Essex, they broke through in the north and a fairly miserable time in London. It's kind of as you would think it would go, but London counts later. And so we woke up to about 80 gains for UKIP. By mid-afternoon, that's only gone up to 85. And
right.
So they've had a good night, by all means, but it's not quite the earthquake people said. Their predicted national share, it's kind of almost a made-up measure that tries to imagine what the national vote would be from today's results. Yeah. Last year's council elections, they hit 23%. At the minute, it looks like they might not even have topped that. So this surge actually looks fairly flat.
Mike, James is basically taking your normal job on this podcast and
yes,
saying
he's a cheeky young fellow. I'm going to have to watch him.
But nothing to get too excited about. What do you think? You excited?
Yeah, I belong to the Keep Calm school of political commentary, and fat good it has done me. No, things change less than we in the media say, because we've got to make things more interesting than they usually are. When they're really interesting, we don't have the vocabulary to describe that either, but that's another story. I think we've got to be careful of the figures until we know them for sure. Nonetheless, as James says, all a bit flat. Interesting, Nigel Farage doesn't play by the rules. He doesn't flatten expectations like a good man from the City of London, he was once a city metal trader, should do with the annual results or the profits or the losses. You kind of manipulate expectation in advance. He said, no, we're going to do fantastically well. And of course, the European election results haven't been accounted. But they've done well enough to put the fear of God into the main parties. And in a way, that's what a sort of anti-politics campaign like UKIP, not really a political party, it's a campaign. That's what it's for.
So, Stephen, we've got two people here refusing stubbornly, really, to get too excited. But has there been anything at all like this since the foundation of the SDP, which, of course, fed into the Liberal Democrats? They've got over a fifth of the vote here, haven't they?
Yeah, and I think you're right to point out the SDP example. And I guess why it's caught the attention, certainly of the media, is that it just throws everything into confusion. So you're used to kind of just trade-offs between Labour Conservative areas, Lib Dem Labour areas, etc. And it's a very clear two-horse race in each of those locations. And now suddenly you have this insurgent fourth force coming through, which means that you can get completely unpredictable results on the back of no predictions from any of the parties whatsoever. So it's unsurprising that when you throw the deck of cards in the air that people get a bit confused as to where they're going to land. Do I think UKIP will last? No, I don't. I think the next year will be a reckoning for them in two ways. One is obviously the general election turnout will be much, much higher. Only one in three people cast their vote yesterday. It'll be two in three at least in a year's time. And secondly, we've seen that the barrage that Nigel Farage has faced over the last week of media abuse, that will continue. And I don't doubt that drip, drip, drip effect will start to have an impact when people actually come to deciding who they want to run the country. I think the big overall thing, of course, and I would say this as a Lib Dem, but is that it's the death of two-party politics, isn't it? That is certainly the big overall impact. And I don't see that going away. It's not just UKIP, there's Greens as well. We have now a multi-party political system, and that's going to throw up lots of unexpected results across the country.
And yet, James, of course, if we're trying to do the indecent thing and say what on earth this means for next year, then we've still got a two-party electoral system, haven't we? No prospect of changing it after AV was killed at birth.
No, I mean, we've kind of ended up very much stuck with the quirks of the electoral system as it is. You know, the Lib Dems didn't get AV, and so in return they did probably the most significant thing for 2015, even more than UKIP, which was not allowing the boundary changes to go through.
Stephen's smiling.
So yes, well. And so we have UKIP will not pull nearly so well next year as they have this year. When we're talking about the NHS, the economy and so on, UKIP are not going to find it easy to get general election votes. But they are going to be an absolute pain in the ass for every party trying to work out which seats are winnable, which seats are defendable. And these kind of voters that we talk about, sort of working class conservatives or the sort of people who could have been tempted to New Labour who don't really like Ed Miliband, they seem to be particularly susceptible to UKIP and might stick around. And that's going to change the maths in all sorts of constituencies in quite volatile ways. And so it's entirely possible UKIP could decide the result of the next election
without winning a single
MP, without actually advancing anything that they believe in. They could still help Labour a great deal. Miliband is much, much more reliant on about the 8% of the electorate that was the sort of left-wing chunk of the Liberal Democrats who are utterly appalled at Clegg and some of the coalition politics than he is on the Blairite sort of New Labour voters who he's probably not going to ever persuade to come over.
I think there's a danger here, my colleagues. I don't disagree with anything they've said, except it's a hyper-rational view of things. And people like us, who are hyper-rational, metropolitan elitists, if you prefer it in Farage speak, sometimes get this wrong. People are very emotional, they're very alienated from politics. A lot of it's their own fault. Hey, voters, it's your own fault. You don't hear that from the parties. They don't concentrate. And then they get cross and, you know, they want everything and they want their Ryanair seat to be perfect as well as 25 quid to get to Portugal. And that's the world we live in. And, you know, they're hacked off. I can see lots of reasons why they're entitled to be hacked off. But don't think just because UKIP is a one policy party and it's the wrong policy anyway, that this kind of vote is going to go away.
But Mike, can I just try on Stephen's point about, you know, it's multi-party politics. Do you think at the general election we're going to see a lot of people voting for these fringe parties?
Well, I think the alienation, everybody knows this figure, but let's say it again. In 1950-51, two elections, about 95%, the voting was 80%, and 95% of voters voted Labour or Conservative. It's now down to 60% turnout, and about 60% of those vote Labour or Conservative. So the duopoly has fractured. But it's a measure of the incoherence of how people feel, and this isn't a jibe at, you know, disaffected working class voters who can't keep up, because the chattering classes are just as incoherent. George Monbiot wrote in The Guardian this week he'd vote SNP to get rid of feudalism in the Highlands, which shows he knows nothing about the SNP. But 2 years ago, people now voting for multi-party politics voted against AV, as I think you or Stephen pointed out, Tom. But logically, they should have voted for AV, and then Nigel Farage would really be in business, wouldn't he?
So what do you do, Stephen? I mean, like, even if it's not the meltdown that some people predicted for the Lib Dems, they've still got it looks like, about half the support that they had at the last general election. They've normally done better in town hall elections. And you're sort of running out of time to win much of that support back.
Yeah, you're right. And I mean, the party's been pushing the line today that if you look at some of the Lib Dem held seats, then the party has exceeded expectations isn't quite the right phrase, but at least done as badly as predicted, which is the height of expectations at the moment. So if you look at Sutton and if you look at Eastleigh and places like that, then the Lib Dems, where they have MPs, have done okay. But then you look at the London results, the Lib Dems have tanked, apart from in Sutton. So it's a very patchy picture for the Lib Dems. What do they do over the next year? Well, it's a bit difficult to know, really, because...
Stephen, what's the relationship between a well-run local council like Eastleigh and the chances of the MP surviving, because the LDs held Eastleigh despite the Chris Shewn scandal, and it was a hugely impressive local campaign, and I've seen that before. I think it's happening in Cheltenham today. They're hanging on when they shouldn't. How does it work?
If you've got the people who can go out on the doorsteps and you've got the active local councillors who know their wards inside out and have good activist networks, then you know, you've got it sorted. But that's not the answer to the whole question, really, because you've got various other places.
It's a start.
It's a start, but you've got areas, and London would be a case in point, where, you know, Brent, Haringey, various places like that, where that exists. You have hard-working councillors. You have seen them out on the doorsteps. There's been a very active campaign from the Lib Dems, and yet the party has still done very badly. So it is not enough in and of itself to be local and to pound the doorsteps. You've actually got to have a good national message as well, and one that resonates. And at the moment, that's what's lacking.
And here's the very dangerous flip side of this. You know, the Lib Dem ground game is famously formidable. And it's really the core of the strategy to surviving 2015. I think everyone in the Liberal Democrats knows it's going to be a tough election. But there is no chance to pick up or to hold councillors, really, after today. Mm. And it's not looking as bad as it could have been, but it's down 200, 250. And 25 Lib Dem seats, kind of parliamentary seats, rely on this kind of voter base, and every councillor brings along 10, 20 activists, lose the councillor, and you do lose a lot of your ground activists.
What do you think, Stephen, in terms of, like, just individuals who were councillors this morning and not councillors by the evening, and some of them will blame Nick Clegg, some of them will be very reasonable and very Lib Dem about it and say, well, you know, these things happen. But do you think that they will be out on the battlefield, as it were, next year? Or do you think they'll be so hacked off that they won't be?
You'll get a mix. I mean, you've got people who are Lib Dem till I die, and you've got people who put in their stint because they've been elected and they feel they owe it to their electorate, who now no longer will have that reason. So you're going to get a mix. Certainly it's the case that there is a clear correlation between where Lib Dems have active local parties and have lots of councillors out and about, and where you get MPs elected. So the fewer of those we have, the less chance we have. It was interesting seeing the Rawlings and Thrasher have done their the sophologists have done their number crunching and reckon that on the basis of today's vote, yesterday's vote that's been counted today, that the Lib Dems would win 40 seats at the next election. Now, I reckon rule of thumb that we're in the range 35 to 45, bad day, good day. It looks like we're somewhere in the middle with 40 seats. To be honest, I think the Lib Dems at the moment bite your hands off at that figure, you know, keeping 40 MPs at the next election.
That's good stuff. If they keep 40 MPs, they ought to be breaking open the cover.
But what about the third or just more than a third of the parliamentary party that knows that means that they're for it? Are they going to start calling for Clegg to go or not?
One of the interesting things over the last 4 years is how resilient or stupid, take your pick of epithets, the Lib Dem MPs have been. That there hasn't been really noises off within the MPs. There has been a House of Lords, obviously they don't have electorates to face, but within the MP body of Lib Dems, it's been, you know, there hasn't been a defection, despite all the predictions. You may remember Charles Kennedy was going to defect, Sarah Tether, all these things. It hasn't happened, so I'd be very surprised if we have a real putsch against Clegg. The only way it will happen is if Clegg stepped down voluntarily.
And I can't see that
happening. No.
And you're quite right. I expected the party perhaps to have a grassroots break. That's what happened with Lloyd George Asquith and later on too. You look at the history books, but it didn't happen. And they got nowhere else to go. They're going to stick with Clegg. They're going to hang together between now and Election Day, or they'll hang separately.
Clegg is remarkably useful for an ambitious Lib Dem right now, though. You know 2015's got to be awful, whoever is in there. And so he's
40
there.
40 seats isn't awful, James.
It's you losing 17 is not what you want to do as a new leader, though. You
it's
know,
not the battle of the
losing
storm.
17 is a victory.
And losing, prospectively, half your vote share. Could you hang on as leader after that?
Exactly. So you keep Cleggan.
So you watch him
if
do
the
it.
Tories are the biggest party, he is someone they can work with. If they are not, he can be thrown out to sacrifice and they can bring in someone left-wing that Labour would find acceptable.
Yeah, that's plausible.
Clegg is very, very useful for them. It's just whether he knows he's a sacrificial lamb or
so
not.
So we've dealt with the Lib Dems.
Unfortunately, the Labour Party is not doing that well enough to make that plausible scenario particularly plausible.
Well, let's move on to Labour and the Tories now, Mike. Who's going to have the biggest headache with all this?
I suspect Cameron will feel it's not been too bad. I think we've got to see the numbers in the round when we've got them all. So
there's odd places where they're creeping up a little bit, the Tories, aren't there? There's a few places in the Midlands where they picked up the odd seat.
The real problem is for Ed Miliband, who didn't have a particularly good week in Swindon or with his grocery bill. And that kind of plays to a narrative that Ed is a sort of metropolitan pointy head. I expect half the voters think he went to Eton, not to a comprehensive school in North London, which he did. That's life. Labour should be doing better, and they're not. And even though John Mann points it out, and he's usually wrong about things, you know, it's not been a great night, no.
But James, you're a bit more sanguine on Labour's behalf, if I can call you that.
A little. We have four parties in this particular election, and so to increase your share, and they've increased it respectably, they've got more councils, they're not winning the Blairite kind of sort of potential sort of middle of the road, possible working class Tory, Essex type voters, but
nowhere in Essex, are they?
No, but it's never really felt like that was Ed Miliband's strategy, and we should not forget they have the soft, wet half of the Liberal Party. That sounds awful, but they do.
They need to win in the South.
They need to. They do, and, you know, they could pick up in, they could and should pick up in London. They are picking up councils in London. It is not a comfortable position for Labour, but it is not quite the disaster it's being painted to be. And the Conservatives are really getting away with a lot with everyone, you know, all the demonisation is happening to UKIP and all the collapse narrative is happening to the Lib Dems, and
James Cameron
is getting away with running quite an unimpressive operation.
But James, yep. The baseline here is 2010, Labour's second worst defeat and all that. What, in vote share, how far are they up compared to?
They are not up a great deal, but on-year elections work quite well for Labour. Labour has quite a few voters who turn out on a general election who don't turn out for a local. The issue profile of this election has been rubbish for Labour. They are not trusted on immigration, they are not trusted on Europe, and that's where the battleground has been. And so, actually,
they're not trusted on the economy either, which is the most important of the three.
Well, yes, and I think this is where the difficulty comes for them next year. But I think this time, no, they haven't done particularly impressively, and I would not feel comfortable if I were Labour right now that I would be the biggest party next year, but I don't think it's the disaster that other people think it is.
What do you think, Stephen?
I think it's a disaster if you want to have a Labour majority next year, because I think it's very clear that's not going to happen based on these results. I mean, William Hague won 2,500 new councillors, and Ed Miliband's not matching William Hague. So I really don't see how Labour are going to actually emerge as anything better than the largest single party after the next election. And we're talking about this as a political earthquake. In fact, what we're really seeing is that we are getting the regression to the mean. We are going to see a repeat of 2010 election, more or less, with a hung parliament and perhaps a reduced Lib Dem rump of 40 MPs. So we've talked about this, you know, UKIP upsurge and all the rest of it. But really, actually, we're going to see pretty much the same result in 2015 as we saw in 2010. And that's the reality. And to be honest, to be fair to Ed Miliband, I'm not sure there's much he could do about it. The narrative was always going to be Labour crashed the economy and an economic recovery was always going to take place somehow. I mean, the coalition's done its best to delay it as long as possible through ridiculous policies. But nonetheless, it was always going to bounce back at some stage, in which case Labour's was always going to find the pendulum turning against it. So I'm not one of those people who slates Ed Miliband over it. I think it was just something he's fighting against the pendulum of history here.
Although, wouldn't it be nice if Labour had anyone who spoke like a human? I mean, they sound like a party led by, run by four policy wonks. It's, you know, why don't they have someone who can turn their leader eating a bacon sandwich and looking like a tit doing it into something funny. Why can't they disarm it? Why can't they talk like a man in the street? That's why they're so vulnerable to Farage. But
this
frankly,
is true of all the parties.
Yes,
isn't it?
They're very intimidated, and they're intimidated by the press. Let's not leave the press out of it. We are cynical and abusive at an amazing level.
And do you think, Mike, that if we had political parties, though, that were led by, I don't know, let's say Eric Pickles and David Blunkett, just, you know, people who didn't look like they'd been cut out of a flat pack, then UKIP would still be doing well.
It would certainly help. I feel bound to point out that William Hague is an authentic Yorkshireman, and he sounds like a Yorkshireman, but he too is a bit of a wonk. He once said about David Miliband, whom I must admit I would have preferred as Labour leader, what do I know, that if people don't like a wonk. I know I'm a wonk myself. And that's, you identified the problem. Pickles and Blunkett? No, well, Pickles is not the man that Blunkett was, but I don't think either of them are leadership material. But it would be help to have a clever man from outside the M25 and Oxford, wouldn't it?
OK, well, you can get the full picture of what's happened in every council on our website, and you can log in on Sunday evening for all the results in the European elections, which are expected to start rolling in sometime after 10 p.m. But if elective politics is looking scrappy this morning, unelected politics hasn't had a good week either. The Prince of Wales has found himself in hot water after he made remarks to a member of the public who'd fled Germany in the 1930s as a young child about Vladimir Putin, saying he was up to the same old tricks as Hitler. Stephen, my first thought was to say that to, never mind if you're the Prince of Wales, never mind if you're being listened to by the Daily Mail. It's a slightly tactless thing to say to anyone who'd been running away from Hitler, wasn't it? That he was up to the same old tricks, Putin?
Yeah, he's clearly taking the Duke of Edinburgh approach to diplomacy. Mind you, I was actually quite relieved to hear Prince Charles at least speak out against Putin, because I kind of imagine Prince Charles would be a UKIP voter and therefore, therefore a Putin lover. I mean, my personal view is that, look, Prince Charles, it's a kind of a hot mic incident. That said, it was at a public appearance. It's not just like a private email has been linked or anything like that. So he's got a certain amount of accountability here. And if it had been something that I disagreed with him on, how would I feel then? If it had been his views on grammar schools, or if it had been his views on homeopathy, would I then be as relaxed about Prince Charles speaking out in this way? I probably wouldn't. I doubt The Guardian would either. So
should we be relaxed, Mike? Because whether you agree with him or not, it was some... It's getting into serious territory, isn't it? It's not homeopathy. It's created a real headache for the Foreign Office.
Well, homeopathy costs the NHS a great deal of money because they're afraid of green ink letters from Charlie Windsor. I thought, here he was. He's an old age pensioner. He's been Prince of Wales longer than anybody in history. Poor old soul. And he said something kind to an old lady in Canada. Unfortunately, there was a Daily Mail reporter doing what Daily Mail does so well, causing trouble. She caught him on it. The Russians take enormous offence about the Hitler business. Of course, Putin lost his older brother in the siege of Leningrad, St. Petersburg, as we call it again. And Russian, and they lost 20 million. You just have to keep repeating this. The fact that Stalin was also a monster makes Russian feelings very complicated. But, you know, we didn't have losses like that, so you have to be careful. Charlie Windsor meant no harm. He's not like his father. That's so unfair, Stephen. he's a well-meaning. He's Lib Dem or a New Labour. He's you know, a bit hopeless. The Queen's got the right idea. Say nothing. I don't think it matters greatly. It was an off-the-cuff remark a long way away, and it's been blown out of proportion by all the usual idiots. God bless them. People talked about him abdicating. He's not king yet, dear. And then the Russians come on and get all heavy about the monarchy. But, you know, it was Putin's old firm which bumped off Charlie's Uncle Nicky. They don't forget this stuff. Dropped him down a mine shaft in Ekaterinburg. These royals, they remember these family slights. It cuts both ways.
James, finally, you spend most of your days now in the American Republic. How does it look over there to have like these kind of prospective head of state able to sound off on matters of diplomacy?
Oh, they laugh at us a great deal. They love the royals and then get... except when I get anywhere near politics, where they completely sort of laugh at us. I mean, they regard it as an excellent soap opera, which is frankly how the rest of us should do, but, you know, without subsidising them. To briefly join the usual idiots, sorry, Mike, you do start to feel that Charles doesn't really want the job anymore, does he? It's, you know, this newspaper is sort of in a legal case to try and get... 15 of his green ink letters to government departments, which the government assure us are so damaging and political that they would damage his reign if they were ever made public, which makes you wonder, why the heck is he writing them?
He's not going to be king for more than 20 minutes anyway, if he ever gets that far. And, 6 Princes of Wales, I counted them last night, didn't. And he's known since he was a little boy that he's drawn the short straw. I feel very sorry for him too. The case for republicanism is less constitutional than humanitarian. I take the view that we have a republic, we just have an hereditary president. It doesn't do much harm, and the Americans laugh at us, but they enjoy it all. And you put a royal within 100 yards of the average American, they're trying to curtsy.
OK, my thanks to James Ball, Stephen Tall and to Michael White. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks very much indeed for listening.